At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we're excited to bring you the news. But before we do, some housekeeping, as they say on podcasts. First of all, please check out our series, Welcome to the Crusades. We're actually going to be doing a bonus episode, right, Derek? Tell me I'm right about that. I believe we decided this for that series.
You're a little ahead of the game here. I don't want to preview anything too hard, but yes, there's going to be at least one bonus episode. It's going to be a few weeks though before we have that out, and there may be more than one. We'll see how it goes.
You will get free with money bonus episode. So again, please check that
free with
out.
Money. There you go, free with money.
That's America, baby.
You pay us, and we'll give you for free this content. Okay.
Yeah. So again, check out welcometothecrusades.com. We've actually only gotten really nice feedback. So again, thanks for everyone who purchased the series and listened to it and has let their friends know about it. We really do appreciate it. And it looks like this has been successful enough that we could do another one. But make it even more successful by going to welcometothecrusades.com. Again, that's welcometothecrusades.com. And before we dive into news, the reviews have actually also been really helpful. There's some stuff going on behind the scenes that I probably shouldn't talk about, but the reviews have been helpful with that. So if you could really take a moment out of your day to just go over to the Apple Podcast app and give us a review, and even write a review. Derek, all the written reviews, they're pro Derek, I have to say. Got to be honest, some anti Danny, but I accept that. Comes with the territory. But if you can go to the Apple Podcast app and review it, we really do appreciate it. We put a lot of work into the show, and that actually really does help us. All right. So we gave you some joy at the beginning to give you some sadness right now. This is going to be not a happy one, at least at the beginning. But Derek.
I don't think we've got any happy ones going on.
Tell
here,
us yeah. about this new study that has revealed we have lost a significant amount of groundwater.
I mean, it's not surprising, I think, to most people that the Earth is losing fresh water, that we're depleting it faster than it can be restored. But there's a new study that was published in the journal Science Advances, I believe late last week, and ProPublica wrote a big piece about it that people can check out a few days ago. Basically, it says where a lot of attention has been paid to the loss of fresh water at colder latitudes due to glacier melting, just as big, if not a bigger driver of the drying out of the Earth is the over exploitation of groundwater aquifers in more temperate latitudes. According to the study, 101 countries are seeing a net decline in water supply that covers nearly 6 billion people. And it affects obviously drinking, irrigation, farming, you know, and anything that you would use, be looking to use fresh water for. The water is disappearing. It's being pumped out of the ground too fast. It is, you know, then obviously being lost. It's contributing to ocean rise, and contributing to a phenomenon that scientists have been noticing, which is that the ground is less able to absorb water. Now it's so dried out that in some places that runoff has become a bigger problem. So yeah, not good news. I mean, I don't know, you know, how to couch this. This is pretty bad stuff. The overuse of aquifers accounts for, I think 68% is what the study found, of the total loss of fresh water in these lower latitudes or more temperate latitudes, which is where most of the human population lives. So, you know, a thing that is affecting the bulk of humanity is not going to get better, is likely not going to get better. So good news.
Really good news. This one's going to be grim. Let's talk about Israel-Palestine. And let's start with the fact that the ceasefire talks appear to have broken down.
They broke down last week. And I think we probably hinted at this in last week's news episode. I can't remember. But Hamas submitted on Wednesday, last Wednesday, a response to an amended response to the most recent ceasefire proposal. And instead of using that as the basis for continuing negotiations, the Israeli government just packed up and left the ceasefire talks in Qatar. The U.S. government followed suit. Hamas's delegation hung around for a little while, but then withdrew, I think, over the weekend. So the talks have completely broken down at this point. It's hard to envision what could get them back on track other than, you know, there has been, and we'll talk about this, there's been growing international pressure on Israel as images of starving children, starving people are coming out of Gaza as, you know, more and more people die of at least malnutrition-related reasons. There is pressure on the Israelis to do something to alleviate this. And the only thing that will really alleviate it is a full ceasefire, and as we saw earlier this year, and flooding the territory with aid. You know, whatever gimmicks the Israelis come up with, and they've tried a few at this point, that fall short of that, are not going to solve that problem. So that may be the only thing that gets anybody back to the negotiating table at this point. But it's clear that over 2 weeks leading into the breakdown last week, they were supposedly negotiating. And supposedly making progress. It's unclear to me whether they made any progress at all, given what we know about Hamas's amended response last week and the ground that it covered. It was still the same stuff and the same basic problems that they had with the original framework. I didn't see any evidence of any movement on those fronts. So, you know, really, really not sure how you get back to a negotiation that could actually get somewhere, you know, we'll see.
Let's continue talking about Israel-Palestine, and let's talk about this Israeli pause of humanitarian aid.
Right, due to the international pressure, mostly the Israeli military announced on Sunday that it was instituting what it's called tactical pauses in three parts of Gaza. Mowasi, so-called humanitarian safe zone. I say so-called because they still bomb it fairly frequently for a safe zone. Deir al-Balah, which is the city in central Gaza, and Gaza City, the main city in the territory in the north. It's pausing activity in those three parts of the territory for 10 hours per day, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. local time, for an additional, 7 hours on either side of that, 4 hours before and 3 hours after. The IDF says it is opening or ensuring the opening of secure routes for humanitarian aid trucks to get from border checkpoints to places where the aid can be to these three zones where the fighting is supposed to stop, they can distribute the aid. I will note there has been no discernible decrease in casualties, which you would maybe expect. I don't know. I mean, if you're pausing fighting for 10 hours a day in three of the most heavily populated at this point parts of Gaza, you might expect to see some decline in casualties. I've seen none. The Israelis are still killing dozens of people per day, including people who are queued up waiting for aid. That has continued throughout all of this. I hesitate to say it's nothing. It's not nothing, but it is a gimmicky response to a very real problem. And it's the Israelis trying to do the least they could possibly do to make it seem like they're addressing the man-made famine in Gaza, when in fact they're really not. People are still dying of starvation. It's still, the UN has said, it's still very difficult to get aid in. They're not seeing a lot of change on the ground in terms of how that process is going. So, you know, that's about it. I think it's a more PR program than anything else. And likewise, they also, late last week, reinstituted airdrops. Airdrops are a horrible way to get aid into a place that is under the kind of pressure that Gaza is under. But it looks like you're doing something. And I think that's the main consideration.
And what about the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation? It's come under new scrutiny.
This has been partly, or mostly, I guess, this week because of one particular former GHF mercenary or security contractor, however you want to term it, a man named Anthony Aguilar, who has been doing the media rounds recounting basically the horror stories that he saw while working security for these GHF aid distribution points. He's been on a number of shows. He's talked about the treatment that these GHF contractors, to which they subjected, starving people, starving Palestinians, queuing up for aid, using live ammunition as crowd control. There was one story where he said he gave some food to a child who thanked him, and then the child's walking away and Israeli soldiers shot and killed him, inside of Aguilar. So it's been, yes, just, another round of basically horror stories about this organization and what it's been doing, what it and the Israeli military in collusion have been doing to the people in Palestine, or people in Gaza, I should say. Aguilar's come under some criticism from the GHF, which insists it's, succeeding in its mission to deliver aid to the Palestinians despite all the deaths and all the starvation. So, yeah, he's taken a little bit of criticism for, as a, kind of bad apple, somebody who was fired and was unhappy about it or disgruntled in some way. But really, the stories that he's telling, I think, not only align with what people can see with their own eyes or, what reporters have been saying for several weeks now, but are just shocking things to the conscience and just to hear. What's been going on.
And we shouldn't ignore also what's been happening in the West Bank. So, Derek, could you tell us what's been going on there?
We're in the midst, it seems, of another spike in settler violence in the West Bank. There have been a number of attacks on villages. There was a report from, I believe, Reuters earlier this week about a village called Susia, where settlers have cut off water and electricity. We've seen a number of instances of settlers kind of going into places and having violent altercations with the Palestinian residents. One incident, several people have died in these things. Several Palestinians have died, have been killed. In particular, an activist named Auda Hathaline was killed in the Masafer Yatta area. He was a participant in the documentary about that region that won the Academy Award, most recently for documentary, he was gunned down by a settler. It was caught on video. The whole incident. The settler was then was detained briefly by Israeli authorities and then released into house arrest, while several Palestinians who were picked up in that same incident remain in Israeli custody. So it's all kind of a joke, just the concept of law enforcement at this point. We've seen a steady rise, especially over the last, I would say, week or so, in violence in the West Bank and in settlers with the collaboration of Israeli security forces brutalizing Palestinians in various parts of the territory.
Let's talk about what friend of the show Felix Biederman, I believe, referred to as a pre-land acknowledgement, which is that Emmanuel Macron Keir Starmer and others have talked about recognizing a Palestinian state, and it just made, when Felix said that, just made me laugh.
Yeah, that's a pretty good line. This is the new wave. You know, this is what we're doing to demonstrate that we're so mad at Benjamin Netanyahu, and he needs to stop because we're really mad at him. Emmanuel Macron has been the driver behind, there was a 3-day event this week, UN event, to discuss somehow reviving the zombie two-state solution. And Macron kind of fired the first shot here late last week when he said that after having dithered about this for several months earlier this year, that the French government will recognize a Palestinian state during the UN General Assembly session in September. That sparked a number of other governments during this 3-day conference that happened this week, including Australia, New Zealand, several other countries, to indicate that they will also recognize a Palestinian state in September. And then that brings us to Keir Starmer, who found a way to be even less decisive, announced that his government might recognize a Palestinian state in September, but he wants to see what the Israelis do between now and then in terms of the situation in Gaza. If there's a ceasefire, if they've taken steps to rectify the humanitarian situation, if they've taken some nebulous steps toward, establishing a Palestinian state, or the furthering the two-state solution, then he will not go ahead with recognizing Palestinian statehood. There's not really a lot of objective standards here in the announcement that he offered, except for the ceasefire, really. So if there's a ceasefire in Gaza, basically Starmer will find a way to back out of recognizing Palestinian state. But otherwise, he may be on the spot to do that. So, you've got a number of countries, major European countries, major Anglosphere countries, saying that they're going to recognize Palestinian statehood. To Felix's point, it's all empty rhetoric. All these countries do, especially European countries. I mean, there's, I think, 150 or so at this point, UN members. Recognized UN members have recognized the Palestinian state, and it's done nothing for the Palestinians, because most of them, at least the ones in Europe, the Arab governments, regard this as basically checking off a box. Like, look, see what I did. I recognized the Palestinian state. Now we can forget that it exists and move on to other things. And there's no benefit that ever, tangible benefit that accrues to the Palestinians as a result of this. There's no willingness to pressure Israel or anything like that. It's just sort of a demonstration piece. They typically leave it at that.
Okay. Let's move on to Trump threatening to bomb Iran again.
This is exciting. On Monday, Trump was at his touring his properties in Scotland, I guess, over the weekend, and he had a Monday meeting with Starmer and had a press conference afterwards, in which, among other things, he threatened to bomb Iran again if Iran insists on continuing its uranium enrichment program, as Iranian officials have said they will. They say they have a right to do so under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So this, I think, points to the indecisiveness of the so-called 12-day war and the likelihood that we may find ourselves back in another conflict with Iran again, because it military conflict for this particular issue is incredibly ineffective, and there's no indication of negotiations. In fact, the Iranians this week said that they have no plans to hold further nuclear talks with the U.S. Go figure. After you bomb a country, they don't want to talk to you anymore. I think the possibility, the longer this drags out without a negotiated diplomatic resolution to Iran's nuclear program, the likelihood that Trump will go back to this well, or that the Israelis will drag him back, will take him back, just as they did last month, it just gets bigger and bigger. The Iranian foreign ministry, in addition to saying they have no plans for further negotiations with the U.S., also said in the same statement that their continued participation in the non-proliferation treaty is dependent on whether or not they are allowed to maintain their enrichment program. And if there is, you know, another attack, if there's another move to, you know, kind of strike any enrichment sites, and, you know, who knows at this point where the Iranians might open new ones or if they'll try to restore the ones that were damaged in the bombing. But if they feel like they're not being allowed to exercise what they regard as a national right under the NPT, they will withdraw from the NPT, which then opens up all kinds of possibilities in terms of weaponization, or at least the impression, the threat of weaponization, and that could lead to, obviously, additional conflict.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on to Myanmar, which you've been focusing on off and on over the last few months. And let's begin with Trump relaxing sanctions.
This is a heartwarming story. Trump last Thursday lifted sanctions on a number of businesses and business leaders with ties to Myanmar's military junta. They didn't offer an explanation for this, but it's probably the result of a letter that the leader of the Myanmar junta, Min Aung Hlaing, sent to Donald Trump earlier this month that was very obsequious. It was in the context of the trade negotiations, which we'll talk about, some of these trade negotiations later, but sort of, you know, appealing to Trump to lower the tariffs that he had threatened to impose on Myanmar, offering, you know, much lower tariffs on U.S. products. But it was more the language of just like flattering Trump and appealing to Trump and being very deferential. And it seems like probably Trump liked that so much that he's decided that the Myanmar junta is good and he likes it. And so he's doing them the solid of lifting sanctions on these firms. There are other factors here we'll get into in a moment.
You're referring, I believe, to this mineral deal.
I am. There are reports, Reuters reported this week, for example, that the Trump administration is considering a number of proposals for accessing Myanmar's critical mineral reserves. Now, most of those critical minerals, the ones that are being mined currently, go to China. So given Trump's fascination with the mineral sphere and with breaking China's monopoly on it, reducing U.S. dependence on China for these things, just as he's trying to do in the Congo, where the peace deal between Rwanda and the Congolese government, the DRC government, and M23 is all kind of oriented around this idea that the U.S. wants to come in and exploit Congolese minerals. And, you know, take them directly and not let them go to China. It's a similar situation in Myanmar. The logistics of this, given Myanmar's proximity to China, are mind-boggling how he thinks he's going to do this. But reportedly, the administration is considering these proposals. They basically break down along two lines. A lot of Myanmar's critical mineral reserves right now are under the control of various rebel groups. The Kachin Independence Army, for example, controls a very large area that produces a lot of these minerals and trades with China. So there are proposals for the U.S. to basically deal with these rebel groups, groups that are opposed to the junta directly, or to go through the junta, which would require, just as, you know, similar to the Congo, coming in and trying to negotiate peace deals between the junta and the various rebel groups. And then the junta, you know, as part of that, regaining control over its mineral reserves or the country's mineral reserves, which it would then graciously ship off to the United States or however they think this would work. So, yeah, it may also be that Trump is kind of eyeing these minerals up and thinking about, you know, who would be best to deal with and finding, leaning toward the junta at this point. But that's speculation on my part.
Speaking of the junta has lifted a state of emergency. Tell us about it.
The junta is planning to hold elections by the end of the year. There's a lot of skepticism about this, obviously, about whether there'll be so-called free and fair elections, about how they would manage to hold elections in the vast swaths of the country that are not under the junta's control right now. you know, or you know, logistically how this would work. So, you know, to be determined. But on Thursday, it did end the state of emergency that has been in place since February 2021, the most recent military coup in Myanmar when the junta took over. It empowers the sort of civilian-esque, I guess, transitional government, which also happens to be led by Min Aung Hlaing, the junta leader. So there's not much of a difference in administration, but there is, I guess, a paper shift from outright military government to the military-backed interim government. This is supposed to clear the path toward holding elections. The junta has called on these rebel groups to kind of lay down their arms and participate in a new round of elections. As I say, a lot of skepticism about whether any of them will or whether they would believe any election result that comes out of the junta. It's very much remains to be seen. But I think the state of emergency, lifting the state of emergency, is fairly significant given how long it's been in place.
Staying in the region, let's talk about the ceasefire that Thailand and Cambodia have agreed to.
It was negotiated on Monday. The prime ministers of both countries went to Malaysia. They met with Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim of Malaysia, and he was able to mediate a ceasefire. This is not a permanent settlement. It's not even really a permanent ceasefire. It is more of an interim arrangement. It's certainly nothing that they discussed addresses the core issues, which are a border that has been in dispute since essentially since French colonial times at this point. But the fighting did stop. As we talked last week, the fighting had broken out on Thursday morning between the Thai and Cambodian militaries after weeks of tension that started with a relatively minor border skirmish in which a Cambodian soldier was, I believe, was killed. That escalated into diplomatic back and forth. There was a withdrawal of ambassadors and expulsion in the days leading up to the opening of conflict. And they spent all weekend, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, basically, you know, shelling back and forth across the border. There was at least at one point airstrikes by the Thai Air Force, but mostly this seems to have been cross-border shelling. And then on Monday, they were able to negotiate the ceasefire. It has been a shaky couple of days. There have been multiple reports and claims, especially on the Thai side, about violations of the ceasefire. These have, I think, been restricted to small arms fire along the border, so not as heavy as what we were seeing before the ceasefire, and nothing that has threatened the ceasefire itself, although, as I say, it's been a shaky couple of days. There's also a dispute emerging about the status of a group of Cambodian soldiers. The Cambodian government says that 20 of its soldiers were illegally captured by the Thai military in the last hours, either, you know, immediately before the ceasefire went into effect or just after the ceasefire went into effect. The Thai military claims it's holding 18 Cambodian soldiers who surrendered to them, you know, make of that what you will, and says it will return them to Cambodia once a permanent ceasefire has been negotiated. But this could be an issue that prevents the negotiation of that permanent ceasefire, frankly, because it's gotten, you know, it's contributed to these tense couple of days as they're kind of going back and forth accusing one another of ceasefire violations. This seems to be a major concern of the Cambodian government. So, to be determined, I think, on this.
Thanks, Derek. And pretty big news, which actually hasn't gotten as much coverage as one might have expected. Trump has made moves on Taiwan, and specifically, he's been canceling interactions with the country. So what's been going on there?
Right. The president of Taiwan was set to make an upcoming visit to the United States. Lai Ching-te was set to make a visit to the United States, as ever, when Taiwanese presidents visit the United States. They do so under the guise of a trip to Latin America and making a stopover in the U.S. This is for basically show, because it allows the U.S. and Taiwan to maintain that nobody's violating the One China policy, and you know, there's no reason for the Chinese government to get upset about this. It's a fiction. You know, these are definitely intentional. You know, the U.S. is the headline always of these trips, but you know, they will, you know, these Taiwanese presidents will typically then continue on to visit a couple of Latin American countries and then come back, probably stop in the U.S. again, have more meetings, and then finally head back to Taiwan. Well, Lai was supposed to make such a trip in the not too distant future, I believe. He's canceled that at the behest of the Trump administration. The supposedly, it may have even gotten to the point where the U.S. simply denied Lai permission to enter the United States. This is largely in the context of something we'll talk about later, the U.S.-Chinese trade negotiations and the Trump administration not wanting to do anything to upset that particular situation or rile the Chinese government up while those things are going on. So that's one of these meetings that's been canceled. The more interesting one to me, and I mean, you know, obviously canceling a visit by the Taiwanese president is a pretty big deal. But the more interesting one to me is that the administration, this is according to the Financial Times, was apparently planning to invite Taiwanese Defense Minister Wellington Koo to Washington for a meeting with people at the Pentagon, senior Defense Department officials. This is unheard of. I mean, since 1979, since the U.S. government switched recognition from Taipei to Beijing, it is unheard of for an official that senior, especially a defense minister, to be invited to Washington. So that's interesting in and of itself. It has now, of course, canceled that meeting as well, for the same reason, because it doesn't want to rile up China while these trade negotiations are going on. But I find it very interesting that it even entertained the possibility of this. I can't imagine any previous U.S. administration having even considered the possibility of inviting a Taiwanese defense minister to Washington for an open visit like this. It's really been unthinkable since 79 for the U.S. to do something like that.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on this one. This could potentially be a good, a big deal. I guess good depends on the eye of the beholder, but certainly a big deal. Let's move on to the Sudan Quartet canceling its meeting after the Egypt-UAE dispute. So, Derek, first of all, what were the Egypt and the UAE fighting about? And then why was the meeting canceled?
The quartet is made up of the U.S., Saudi Arabia, the two countries that started out for the first few months after the Sudanese military and the Rapid Support Forces went to war with each other, trying to mediate a negotiating process, and then gave up because it wasn't going anywhere. So the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Egypt and the UAE. Egypt is a strong backer of the Sudanese military. The UAE has been arming, although I should note, Emirati officials deny this. There's mountains of evidence at this point that the UAE has been arming and supporting the Rapid Support Forces and getting RSF to ship gold out of Sudanese mines to the UAE in return. You know, it's basically the four countries who feel they have a vested interest in trying to see how this conflict goes. They were supposed to have held a meeting this week in Washington to discuss the situation in Sudan, which continues to deteriorate. There's an increased fighting in the Kordofan region. There are, you know, reports of people starving to death in Darfur and various parts of Darfur. I think this week in a displaced persons camp in East Darfur state, there were reports of starvation deaths occurring. The Sudan Doctors Network reported that. UNICEF has been reporting massive increases this year over last year in the number of children being treated for severe malnutrition. So, you know, just the usual horrible things happening in this conflict. They were supposed to get together and try to discuss what's going on. They broke down. The talks broke down before they really even got started. There was a proposed statement that the quartet was going to issue in which the UAE team had drafted a section, or it was insisting on wording that would exclude both the RSF and the Sudanese military leadership, as it's currently comprised, from participating in the post-war transition. The Egyptian government reportedly rejected that. As I said, the Egyptian government supports the Sudanese military pretty strongly. So they objected to the exclusion of the military, which, you know, has claimed to running the so-called legitimate, if you want to look at it that way, government of Sudan, at least the internationally recognized government of Sudan. And so the Egyptians rejected their exclusion from the post-war transition, and they were unable, apparently, to find a compromise. So the whole exercise just kind of fell apart.
Big news! Wayfair's end-of-season sale is here. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus, amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on home finds in every style. This is your last chance to score end-of-season savings, and it's happening now. Did we mention fast shipping on everything? Don't wait. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off now through September 2nd.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Let's talk about Trump slashing the deadline for Russia to end the war in Ukraine.
On Monday, during his press conference with Starmer, he announced that this 50-day deadline that he had given Russia to wrap up the war in Ukraine, lest he impose harsher penalties, economic penalties on Russia, probably around Russian oil. That would include secondary sanctions on anybody who buys Russian oil, et cetera, that he had slashed that to 10 to 12 days. On Tuesday, he further clarified and said he was giving Russia 10 days from today, today being Tuesday, which puts the deadline now at the end of next week for Russia to make at least progress. When he announced the initial 50-day deadline, the stipulation was the war has to be over, basically, or there has to be at least a ceasefire in place for Russia to avoid these sanctions. Now, with the shorter deadline, he seems to be talking about progress toward a ceasefire or progress toward ending the war. Whatever it is, the Russian government has been pretty noncommittal about anything. It hasn't really commented heavily. Dmitry Medvedev, who's the mouthpiece of the Russian Security Council, used to be president and prime minister and kind of fell out of favor, but has become their loudest yapping dog at this point. Warned that Trump was risking war between Russia and the United States, and Trump has gotten into a back and forth with him. It's all very irrelevant. But the relevant thing is that I don't see the Russian government really reacting to this or acting as though it's in any critical need to resolve anything. And I should know, Danny, that this is actually so new that I didn't even have time to put it on the news outline. But there are reports.
That's fine. We'll
now,
just dock your pay this month. No
yeah,
worries.
I understand. There are reports now that the Russian military has captured the town of Chasiv Yar, which is in Donetsk Oblast, very important strategic kind of high point in Donetsk. The Russian military has been trying to seize control of it for months now, has gained control of part of it, but the Ukrainian forces are still defending part of the town. The Russian military is now claiming that it's captured it in total after, this is what NBC is reporting, 16 months of fighting. The Ukrainian government is denying this. It says the Russians are still only control part of the town and they're trying to make more of this than what it is. But if they have taken it, that's a pretty significant development, and we could see follow-ons from that. As I said, it's sort of a strategically located town, so it could bolster Russian advances in other parts of that province. We'll have to wait and see.
Trade news. All right, Derek, let's go into trade news.
Yeah.
And let's start with the various deals that have been made with the European Union and also South Korea.
Right, two deals. And at this point, the pattern for these things, the template seems to be that you get the whatever the U.S. tariff is going to be on the targeted country's products, plus some commitment by the targeted country to invest a certain amount of money in the U.S. at Trump's direction, which I just find fascinating. Like, how is this permissible? And then some commitment from the target country to buy U.S. energy exports, a sum of U.S. energy exports. So the South Korean deal, we don't have a lot of detail on it. It was announced, I believe, on Wednesday. The headlines there are a 15% tariff, U.S. tariff on South Korean products. South Korea agrees to invest $350 billion in the U.S., again, as directed by Donald Trump, and purchase $100 billion in U.S. energy products. The timetables for those, you know, whether that's over 2 years, 3 years, I don't know. It's unclear from this deal. This follows from the EU trade deal, which is the bigger deal, was announced over the weekend, and then Monday, Trump went into some detail about it while he was in Scotland. That deal also imposes a 15% tariff on EU products. This seems to be the number that Trump is favoring for entities or countries that he doesn't have a close connection with. Japan also did, a 15% tariff. So the EU gets EU products to slap a 15% tariff with some exemptions, and those haven't all been worked out. There's still, French wine producers and other kind of specialty food products in particular, but other specialty sectors in the EU are hoping to earn exemptions from that tariff in subsequent technical negotiations that will still have to take place. It also obliges the EU to invest around $600 billion in the U.S. over 3 years, again, presumably at Trump's direction, and to purchase $750 billion in U.S. energy exports, which is a whopping figure. I don't imagine, it's hard to imagine it's hard to imagine that the Europeans will be able to buy that much U.S. energy, but we'll see. It may just have been a number that looked big and Trump liked it, and so they put it in there. But, the devil's in the details, I guess. It's just hard for me to imagine the EU buying $250 billion in U.S. energy per year for the next 3 years. That would be a massive increase.
Derek, like Doug Funny said, you've got to think big. Let's talk about... I don't even think you get that reference. Let's talk about this 25% tariff plus penalties that Trump has put on India.
This was also on Wednesday. He announced a 25% tariff on Indian products. The negotiations with the Indian government are apparently still going on. So it's possible that could be reduced if they reach a deal, but they haven't reached a deal so far. And the deadline's coming up Friday. And then, these things will be imposed, over the coming days. But his artificial deadline has been Friday. So he kind of went ahead and said, we're going to impose 25% tariff on Indian products. But the interesting thing is he announced some unspecified penalty. We don't know what this is. Trump suggested that it was being imposed on India for two reasons. One, because India continues to buy Russian energy products and weapons despite U.S. sanctions. And the other is because India is, of course, a charter member of the BRICS group, and Trump has decided that BRICS is the bane of his existence. He doesn't like it. So he doesn't like any country that's in it. But at the same time, whatever bad feelings he has toward India, Trump and Narendra Modi have always gotten along very well. So it's interesting that the personal relationship doesn't seem to be saving the Indian government at this point. And also, I should say, for many years now, the United States has been working hard under several administrations, not just Trump's, to bring India into the constellation of alliances that it's building in the Indo-Pacific to counter China. And something like this is the kind of thing that could set that process back. So strategically, it may not be the brightest thing to do, by the standards of what the U.S. is trying to achieve in the Indo-Pacific. But Trump is sort of laser focused, I think, at this point on getting these punitive tariffs in place or negotiating these equally punitive but in different ways trade deals.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about this 50% tariff that he put on Brazil.
Speaking of punitive tariffs, this one is fascinating because it's purely about interfering in internal Brazilian politics. Brazil actually has a trade deficit with the U.S., so it doesn't make sense on its own merits that Trump would even, on the merits of this sort of unfair reciprocal tariff scheme that he's developed, to try and balance trade with these countries. Brazil would seemingly be exempt from that because Brazil runs, as I said, a deficit with the U.S. Nevertheless, Trump threatened a few weeks ago to raise tariffs on Brazil to 50%, not for any trade-related reasons, but because he's mad that the Brazilian government is prosecuting his buddy Jair Bolsonaro, the former president of Brazil, for having fomented, or allegedly, I guess, fomented the attempted coup against Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva a couple of years ago when Lula defeated Bolsonaro in the presidential election and before he was able to take power. Bolsonaro has been under investigation. He's been, placed at this point. I think he's got an ankle monitor on, like, to prevent him from leaving the country. So it's gotten pretty serious, and gotten serious even more serious since Trump's threat, which seems to have backfired, in fact, and has caused the Brazilian prosecutors to just go harder at Bolsonaro. Anyway, on Wednesday, he followed through on this threat to raise tariffs to 50%. His administration also blacklisted the presiding judge in the Bolsonaro case, Alexandre de Moraes, who has been on the administration shit list, let's say, both for presiding over the Bolsonaro case and because he's been the lead judge in cases where he's kind of taken on cases about what de Moraes believes is hate speech online, which has affected U.S. social media companies, including X, which Trump at one point was obviously buddies with Elon Musk. That's no longer the case, but, you know, we're still concerned about this stuff. There have been cases involving U.S. social media companies. There have been cases involving Brazilian opposition figures who reside in the U.S. and you know, say lots of fun things online that de Moraes has gone after. So they've been angry at him for that on, you know, so-called free speech grounds. So with all of that, they've frozen his assets in the U.S. It's unclear whether he has any assets in the U.S., but if he does, they've been frozen. So, you know, take that.
They have been frozen if he does, yeah. Kind of like all my rubles being frozen.
Exactly.
Let's talk about Trump and this no deal with Canada.
Trump is angry at Canada because, to go back to something we talked about earlier, Canada was one of the countries, one of the 14 countries this week that announced that it will recognize Palestinian statehood during the UN General Assembly in September. And so he announced on Thursday very dramatically that actually, I can just read you the truth. This is so good. Wow. Canada has just announced that it is backing statehood for Palestine. That will make it very hard for us to make a trade deal with them, he said on Truth Social. So that's it. I don't have anything more than that. But yeah, it's he seems unhappy about that decision. The tariff that will come online on Canadian products is 35%. Now, that's a tariff on anything that isn't already covered under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. Where there's already kind of a guiding principle for either total free trade or whatever mechanism is contained in that deal, so it's unclear how much it's unclear to me. I'm sure somebody's figured this out, but how much of Canadian exports to the U.S. will actually be affected? But it does sound like Trump, in a huff, is no longer interested in negotiating with Canada.
And let's end with the fact that the talks between the U.S. and China have been inconclusive.
Right. The U.S. and China set, people may recall a few months ago, they negotiated an interim set of tariffs that brought down the, 20 trillion percent tariff that Trump had imposed on China. Like, it was 130% or something outrageous, and China had countered with 125% or something on U.S. products. It was just ridiculous. A couple months ago, they negotiated an interim relationship to bring those tariffs down to more realistic levels with a 90-day deadline that was to expire, or is to expire, on August 12th. The two countries, the two governments, sent delegations to Stockholm this week. They met Monday and Tuesday to try and work out, to try and advance the prospects of a more comprehensive trade deal. But at the very least, the aim was to reach a deal to extend that August 12th deadline for, I don't know, probably another 90 days, who knows. That seems to have failed. They agreed to work on extending the deadline, but they did not agree on actually extending it. The U.S. delegation said it had to come back to Washington for consultations with Trump. The Chinese delegation didn't really say much more than we're agreeing to work on extending the deadline. So it's that August 12th deadline is still looming out there, and we could theoretically see, reimposition of these massive, massive tariff levels on both sides if there's no progress or if nothing is done by then. So, as you said, inconclusive. More to come on that, surely.
Inconclusive, elusive. All right, everyone. Nice. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Again, we have two calls for action. One, buy Welcome to the Crusades. You will love it. We guarantee it. That's the American Prestige guarantee. And also, please review us on Apple. We've got about 100 more reviews until we get to 1,000, and I could stop bothering all of you. So thank you all for listening. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.